Well, as we ended our previous lesson, we received a sad, I think almost embarrassing narrative of this aged, this worn down King David, who was standing at the gate of Mahanaim, imploring his war-bound army to go gently with his son, rebellious son, Absalom. Now, one can only imagine the perplexed, even disgruntled reaction of his soldiers and his commanders at such a notion that above all else, they shouldn't seek to harm the very one they're going out to do battle against. Kind of sounds like our modern day war planning, doesn't it, that we know about. The guy that caused all this death, this mayhem, they're supposed to go easy on. And all because David has some twisted sense of loyalty and father-to-son affection towards Absalom that has caused him to somehow overlook the fact that this son had become not only an enemy of David and of God's kingdom, but of God himself. Because Absalom was trying to unseat God's anointed king. Now, we spent a few moments last week exploring Yeshua's admonition and warning in the book of Luke about what the attitude, what the expectation of a believer must be who accepts the honor of being a leader in the community of God worshipers, or even to what a simple follower of Yeshua should be. And ideally, the acceptance of a divine commission of leadership must put obedience and duty to the Lord above all earthly treasures, even one's own family. This isn't something we see happen very often in the Christian community. Most typically, the actual order of importance and value that we establish in our lives is family first, then God. I'm not going to review that part of the lesson from last week, but I would like to make this additional comment so that there's no misunderstanding. It is not the ideal decision to first create a family, then decide to become a devoted leader in the kingdom. But the reality is, it's probably the way it happens most of the time. It's always best to first commit to the Lord, then evaluate if your particular commitment will even accommodate the treasure of a family. Or such a decision should play the pivotal role in choosing a spouse who has to share our commitment wholeheartedly. Otherwise, unwittingly, we may have played a game of bait and switch that's bound to cause terrible family turmoil and pain. That is, we married a person under one set of mutually agreed premises, and then later, in kind of a one-sided decision, decided to make a right turn and pursue a whole different lifestyle and set of priorities, no matter how godly sounding or well-intended it might be. A set that the other spouse just isn't equipped for, hasn't been called by God for, and maybe doesn't genuinely embrace it. Nothing, nothing is more common in Christian leadership today than for a man to marry, produce a couple of children, and then at some later point decide to commit he and his family to ministry. The good Christian wife goes along with it, even if reluctantly, and she tries to make the best of it. The children are pawns. They don't have much choice in the matter. But all too often, this enthusiastic husband and Christian leader suddenly finds himself with a burned out and discouraged wife. Disaffected children who never signed up for this. Thus, the two-part lesson I want to impart to you is this, and it goes for men and it goes for women. It is that while marrying and starting a family first is by no means a disqualification of later participation in Christian ministry and leadership, it does necessarily limit, it narrows the extent and type of assignment one can reasonably commit to. A man in this type of situation cannot be a good, proper, attentive husband and involved father and suddenly nearly abandon his family for the sake of his newfound mission, saying, God comes first now. Rather, because of the path he first undertook, he must take on the commission of leadership, understanding there's going to be limitations on just what he can reasonably undertake. The second part of this lesson is that only a few are actually destined to become full-time Christian leaders. Nowhere in the scriptures do we get the sense that we're meant to have boatloads of Christian leaders in order to lead Messiah's flock. Unfortunately, Christian leadership today has all too often become a vocation, or it's become a profession, not a true divine calling or an anointing. That we might have a great desire to be a Christian leader by no means says we ought to be one, or that God has willed that kind of a life for us and by extension that for our families. Saint Paul cautioned potential leaders in the kingdom about this as well. He even advised that if possible, in the long run, excuse me, it's probably better for a leader to avoid marriage and family, especially if your particular assignment brings you into a very uncertain earthly future. By no means am I saying or advocating, nor does the Bible say, that Christian leadership and family should be mutually exclusive. I'm saying, count the cost. Count the cost before you make a commitment to marriage or to Christian leadership, because one is going to have a very definite effect on the other. I tell you honestly, I was only able to enter Christian leadership because my wife, whom I married before this decision, wholeheartedly wanted to enter it with me as a full partner. Our children were grown, married. In fact, although I won't share the story with you, my wife was the first of the two of us to be given knowledge from the Lord that this was even coming. Neither of us had any idea what it was going to lead to. And especially, she knew significant changes were about to happen in what were our nice, comfortable, leisurely lives. And while we've had our moments of wrestling and difference of opinion over what extent of time and attention we devote to our ministry leadership, that by definition takes away from each other, restricts our freedom of choices, it's worked out because we both realized this has always been our destiny and that we were both prepared to accept whatever the consequences. David, King David, I'm sure, never realized that accepting the position of being God's anointed leader over his chosen people meant that someday he would have to accept the just and punitive death of one of his own beloved children. And then, after it happened, that he would be expected by God to move on and not grieve excessively. So while we can rightly see the wrong in his behavior and his response towards his son Absalom's coming demise, as we're about to read about, we also ought to have some genuine sympathy, some understanding for David. When he entered service to God, he could not, just as we cannot, imagine or see the future. And we ought to always remember this true story of King David whenever we begin to wonder if Christian leadership is for us. Let's reread 2 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to start at verse 6 and read to the end. Page 353 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. So the people went out into the field against Israel. The battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. The people of Israel were defeated there by David's servants. There was a terrible slaughter that day of 20,000 men. For the battle, there was spread all over the countryside. The forest devoured more people that day than did the sword. Absalom happened to meet some of David's servants, and Absalom was riding his mule, and as the mule walked under the thick branches of a big terebinth tree, his head got caught in the terebinth, so that he was left hanging between earth and sky as the mule went on from under him. Someone saw it and told Yoav, "I saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth." And Yoav asked the man who told him, "Here now, you saw it. Why didn't you strike him to the ground then and there? I would have had to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt besides." And the man replied to Yoav, "Even if I were given 1,000 pieces of silver, I still wouldn't raise my hand against the son of the king. After all, while we were listening, the king ordered you, Abishai, and Ittai, be careful no one touches young Absalom. Or if I had pretended that I didn't know, the king would have known otherwise anyway, and you wouldn't have interceded for me either." And Yoav said, "I can't waste time arguing with you." He took 3 darts in his hand and rammed them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive, hanging from the terebinth. Then Joab's 10 young armor bearers surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. Yoav sounded the shofar, and the people returned from pursuing Israel because Yoav held back the troops. They took Absalom and threw him into a big pit in the forest and piled a big heap of stones over him. All Israel fled, each one to his tent. In his own lifetime, Absalom had taken and raised for himself the pillar, which stands in the king's valley, because he said, "I don't have a son to preserve the memory of my name." So he named the pillar after himself, and it's called Absalom's Monument to this day. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, "Let me run now and bring news to the king that Adonai has judged in his favor by releasing him from his enemies." And Yoav said to him, "You are not to be the one to bring the news today. You can convey news another day, but today you will not bring news because the king's son is dead." And then Yoav said to the Ethiopian, "Go, tell the king what you saw." The Ethiopian bowed to Yoav, and then he ran off. But Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said to Yoav, "Come what may, please let me also run after the Ethiopian." And Yoav answered, "Why do you want to run, my son? You won't receive any reward for bringing the news." "I don't care. Whatever happens, I want to run." So he said to him, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by the road through the desert flats, and he outran the Ethiopian. And David was sitting between the two gates, and a watchman went up to the roof of the gate, and he went out onto the wall, and he raised his eyes, and he looked, and he saw there a man running by himself. The watchman cried out, and he told the king, and the king said, "If he's alone, he has good news to tell." And as he ran along and he came close, the watchman saw another man running, and he called to the gatekeeper, "There's another man running by himself." And the king said, "Oh, he too must have good news." And the watchman said, "The first one runs like Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." The king said, "He's a good man. He'll come with good news." Ahimaaz called the king, "Shalom." And he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground and said, "Blessed be Adonai, your God, who has handed over the men who rebelled against my lord, the king." And the king asked, "Is everything all right with young Absalom?" Ahimaaz answered, "When Yoav sent the king's servant and me, your servant, I saw a big commotion, but I don't know what it was. the king said, go, stand over there. So he went and stood there. Then up came the Ethiopian. And the Ethiopian said, there's good news for my lord the king. For Adonai has judged in your favor, and he's rid you of all those who rebelled against you. The king asked the Ethiopian, is everything all right with young Absalom? The Ethiopian answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rebel against you in order to harm you be as that young man is. Some subtle terminology in this passage tells us a lot about the Lord's mindset in this battle between David's and Absalom's forces. Verse 6 says, so the people went out into the field against Israel. In Hebrew, it says that the went out to fight against Israel. As a general rule in the Bible, the term refers to God's people, his set apart people. Yet, isn't Israel also God's people? But here we have one set against the other. The essence of this sentence is that in this instance, we have a battle of the God's true people, against Israel, those who are supposed to be with God, but at the moment they weren't. And as we move along in this chapter and into the next one, we're going to see an amazing series of parallels as a precursor to Messiah's experience and his relationship with his people, the Jews, and with the rest of Israel. St. Paul, in a number of verses, explains that there is a part of Israel that is the true Israel in God's eyes, while there's another part of Israel that has fallen away for the moment and does not express the heaven-born ideal of Israel. The defining, dividing line here in 2 Samuel 18 is those Israelites who stand on one side with God's anointed king David versus those who stand on the opposite side of that line with that evil usurper Absalom. In the New Testament, the dividing line between the and Israel is that the are those Israelites and others who stand with Yeshua, Jesus Christ, versus those Israelites and others who stand against him. In both cases, at the time of David and then later at the time of Christ, it is not that the remains Israel and then the other Hebrews aren't any longer a legitimate part of Israel. Rather, it is that there's part of Israel that remains standing with God, the and another part that's fallen away. But physically, they all remain Israel. And St. Paul doesn't question that. Thus, the true difference between the and Israel, this is in the context of this verse in 2 Samuel and in St. Paul's writings, is this. It's a spiritual difference, not a physical difference. The battle for control of the throne of Israel takes place somewhere in a forest called the Forest of Ephraim. There's an enormous disagreement where this place might be. Many scholars say that this is located not far from Mahanaim, which is in the Transjordan, and the name is not indicative of the tribal territory that it's in. Other scholars say that's preposterous to say that the Forest of Ephraim is in any other place than the tribal territory of Ephraim, which is located on the west side of the Jordan River. Wherever it was, the wooded area was treacherous, apparently, and the very terrain of it itself caused more deaths of Absalom's soldiers than those that were killed by David's men during the battle. The scene is essentially of untrained, undisciplined, panic-stricken troops who fell into pits and fell over cliffs and fell down and broke their legs by catching them between rocks. They were attacked by wild animals, all sorts of stuff. Over 20,000 men of Israel, Absalom's men, died there that day. Verse 9 begins the infamous story now of Absalom's death. Now, the chaotic nature of Absalom's folly continues when, as he's trying to escape this battle and get back to Jerusalem, he rides under a tree in the forest of Ephraim, and he gets caught in it. And his mule, not a donkey, a mule, rides off, leaving him hanging there. Now, lots been made about the ironic nature of Absalom dying because he was hanging by his hair. There's been many fine sermons to draw parallels between Absalom and the Nazarites, who also have long hair, and to other matters of, say, like pride that revolves around having hair. I wouldn't know about that. Just one problem. Not one word in this passage speaks about Absalom's hair. It doesn't say he was caught by his hair, his sear, despite all the English translations that say he was. Rather, it says he was caught by his rosh, his head. He was caught by his head. And ancient Hebrew sages made commentary that it must have been his hair that's being spoken of, and they assumed this because of the pride he had in his hair that we read about early on in the stories of Absalom. Well, he may well have had a forked branch grasp his head, perhaps even stuck under his neck. We're not informed about it one way or another. But I think the point of the story gets diverted if we make the hair the issue, assuming he was even still wearing his hair long by this time. There's no evidence of that. I think the better symbolism from this story is that riding a mule was reserved for royalty in that era. And since the mule is a mix of a donkey and a horse, it was considered against the Torah for Hebrews to breed these animals. It was considered an illicit mixture. So they had to purchase these terribly expensive animals from their neighbors. So here we have Absalom riding a royal mule, holding himself up as the king, and then suddenly a tree gobbles him up and leaves him hanging while his royal mount gallops off. He is royalty no more. And this is a divine sign that the Lord has stripped him of his false claims and exposed him for any commoner who happens by to see that he is not, he has never been, a king over God's kingdom. A soldier happens to see Absalom hanging helplessly in the tree. Instead of doing what a warrior would naturally do, kill the guy, he freezes. He knows who this is. He knows that King David has made it exceptionally clear nobody is to harm Absalom. So he goes to his commander. Yoav tells him what he's found. Yoav is indignant. He wants to know why this soldier wouldn't, of course, do his duty and even take advantage of his good fortune. All the soldier would have had to do is kill this helpless enemy, Absalom, and then he would have collected a handsome reward. He would have even become a renowned man. But the soldier says, no way. Not me. The soldier stands up to his commander and he blusters right back at him that if he killed Absalom, even for a treasure chest full of silver, he wouldn't have done it because the king had given orders against it. Further, says the soldier, while Joab is at the moment dressing him down for not killing Absalom, he equally has no doubt that if he had killed Absalom and David had reacted viciously over it, Joab wasn't going to lift a finger to intervene on that soldier's behalf. Joab stormed off. He took three darts and he stuck them into Absalom's chest. The Hebrew word is shavatim. It means sticks. It doesn't mean darts or spears. The idea is that Joab wounded and incapacitated Absalom, leaving him hanging there half alive for others to finish off. Joab sent his armor bearers now, his personal bodyguard. He sent them now to go and kill Absalom. The number of armor bearers is listed as 10, a minyan. This is to impart the understanding that the killing of Absalom was divinely ordained, as 10 is the number of completion or perfection. The armor bearers did no wrong in slaying Absalom. They were God's hand of justice in this case. Joab was a good general. The moment Absalom was dead, he blew the shofar, because this was a signal to his army to stop pursuing the fleeing Israelites and to return for an assembly. There was no point of killing anymore. It was all over. The cause for the killing was now dead, hanging in that tree. And after all this, it had been a battle, we have to remember, of Hebrew upon Hebrew. And there was no intent to eradicate the opposition to extinction. Further, Joab was a political man. He knew full well that it was time to start the healing process, to start bringing all the tribes back together again under King David. So it would be duly noted by the Israelites that the moment David won, the killing was stopped, and hopefully there wouldn't be blood avengers and a lot of retribution that would occur. But that was yet to be seen. So there was a great deal of apprehension among those who had sided with Absalom over what might become of them. Well, verse 17 explains that Absalom was denied a respectful burial. Rather, he was just unceremoniously thrown into a pit, had rocks piled up on him. This sort of treatment is reserved for the worst of the worst, not for a king's son. Recall the evil Achan, the Hebrew, as Joshua was fighting against the Canaanites, and how Achan stole some of God's holy property from Jericho, and it caused Israel to be humiliated in battle. Let me remind you of that. Back in Joshua 7, 24 to 26, Joshua took together with all Israel, took Achan, the son of Zerah, with the silver, the robe, the gold wedge, his sons, his daughters, his cattle, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and everything he had, and he brought them up to the Achor Valley. Joshua said, "Why have you brought trouble on us? Today Adonai will bring trouble on you." Then all Israel stoned him to death, and they burned them to ashes and stoned them. Over him they piled a great mound of stones, which is there to this day. Finally, Adonai turned away from his fierce anger. This is why that place is called the Valley of Achor, trouble, to this day. In a later event, we see another incidence of a disrespectful treatment of a corpse as punishment for evil that greatly resembles what happened to Absalom. We find that also in Joshua in the next chapter 8. So Joshua burned down Ai, and he turned it into a tell forever so that it remains a ruin to this day. The king of Ai, he hanged on a tree until evening. At sundown, Joshua gave an order. They took his carcass down from the tree, threw it at the entrance of the city gate, and piled on it a big heap of stones, which is there to this day. Well, verse 18 gives this interesting piece of information, that Absalom had raised up a monument to himself before he had died, and that David obviously allowed it to remain standing. And the purpose for this monument is born as much from superstition as from narcissism. But there is a bit of a mystery surrounding all this. Absalom says he did this. Why? He had no sons. And yet, 2 Samuel 14:27 says he had three sons. Some rabbis say that all of his sons had died before Absalom was killed. Josephus, on the other hand, says that's not so. He says that Absalom's three sons were such a disappointment to him that he considered them as having no sons at all. None were suited to royalty in his eyes. None were worthy of succession to the throne. None were even worthy of carrying on the family name. So Absalom's lament, "I have no sons," is an expression. It's a folk saying in which he essentially disowned his sons, so thus he sees himself as no longer having any. The superstitious part of erecting this monument is that it was believed that a person's spiritual essence only continued on in the afterlife for as long as the name is remembered and then spoken out loud. Thus, if his sons are disowned from the family, then their offspring is also not part of the family, and now there's no one to speak Absalom's name. So by having his name inscribed on a public monument to himself, people will come to visit it, look upon it, speak his name, which was a traditional custom since all Middle Easterners subscribed to the same superstition. So he was now assured of an ongoing afterlife. Many say that this monument is today one and the same as Absalom's tomb in the Kidron Valley. It's outside of Jerusalem. That's very doubtful. Now, the location of the monument is given in verse 18 is the King's Valley, and that is indeed very nearby the structure of Absalom's tomb as we see it today. Now, for centuries, it was a tradition that passersby would throw rocks at the monument to show their disdain for Absalom. They would also bring their rebellious children there and punish them and show them that monument to remind them of what happens to rebellious sons, using Absalom as an example. I kind of like that idea. But the reality is that the structure that presently exists was first built in the age of the Greeks, long after the time of Absalom. So it's not clear whether this was or was not the same location of the monument that we're reading about here in 2 Samuel. Anyway, in verse 19, the son of the high priest Zadok is so excited that the war is over and that King David has been victorious that he wants to get to him quickly with the good news, as he knows David is on pins and needles waiting to hear the outcome of this battle. But as the next few passages unfold, it seems evident that while Ahimaaz knew the war was over, he didn't know Absalom was dead. Or if he did, he didn't know how it happened. And Yoav insists that somebody has to run to tell King David what happened, because he knew that David was fully capable of killing this messenger in a fit of rage. And Absalom's status was a lot more important to David than even the outcome of the battle. Ahimaaz, however, was a dedicated young man. He had been the one assigned to personally bring whatever the intelligence had been gathered in Jerusalem about Absalom's plans to King David in Mahanaim. He felt close to the king. He knew that David trusted him. It was his job to inform David of important news, regardless of what it might mean for him personally. But Joab wanted to use a man described in Hebrew as the Cushi, meaning a Cushite, translated better into English in Ethiopian. The Cushi were the race of black-skinned people who at this time lived in Africa, primarily in the north of Africa. Some have tried to make this into a biblical racial issue, but there's no evidence of that. It's just a statement of fact. This Cushite, this Ethiopian, was obviously someone Joab trusted. But remember that Ahimaaz was not only close to David, he was also the high priest's son. So Joab was far more concerned to guard the safety of this person who came from an important family than to be concerned for the well-being of just some common trooper. Well, in the end, Ahimaaz was so determined that Joab allowed both he and this Cushite to go running to David with the news. Ahimaaz was apparently pretty well known as a swift runner. Even his style of running was recognizable. And as he nears the city of Mahanaim, the guard up on the watchtower sees him coming off in the distance, and he calls down to David. David, trying to muster up all the hope he can, he contells himself, "Oh, it's a single runner. This must be good news." Then the second runner spotted. And David insists that, well, but they're running separately, so must be another piece of good news. David, we are told, was sitting literally between the gates. Now, walled cities often had two sets of gates, an inner set and an outer set. It was a double set of protection. It's hard not to see the parallel of David sitting on a chair at the gate with Eli in Samuel's era doing the same thing. But when Eli gets that devastating news about his son's death, he falls over backwards, breaks his neck, and dies. Well, David isn't going to die. He's about to get some pretty devastating news. Ahimaaz arrives. He's the first one. He beats the Ethiopian there, and he approaches the king. And after going through the usual respectful protocol of greeting, shalom, he bursts out that the enemy has been handed over to David. In other words, victory. But David just sloughs that off. He immediately asks about Absalom. Now, Ahimaaz kind of stammers around, says, well, he knows Absalom was captured, and there was some big commotion going on all around him, but he really doesn't know what it was all about. David impatiently dismisses Ahimaaz. Now he questions the Cushite, who's just arrived. And the Cushite soldier naively assumes that Absalom's death is going to be welcome news as confirmation of victory. Wrong. Let's continue our story in chapter 19. We're going to read the first 15 verses of it this evening. Page 354 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Trembling, the king went up to the room over the gate, weeping and crying, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son. My son Absalom, and if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Yoav was told, "The king is weeping, mourning for Absalom." Thus the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day that the king was grieving for his son. So that the people entered the city furtively that day, the way that people who are ashamed creep around when fleeing a battlefield. Meanwhile, the king covered his face and he cried out, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh Absalom, my son, my son." Yoav went inside to the king and said, "Today you've made all your servants feel ashamed. They saved your life today. The lives of your sons, your daughters, your wives, your concubines. But you love those who hate you, hate those who love you. Today you said that princes and servants mean nothing to you. For I can see today that it would have pleased you more if Absalom had lived today and we had all died. Now get up, go out, and speak heart to heart with your servants, for I swear by Adonai that if you don't go out, no man will stay here with you tonight, and that it will be worse for you than all the misfortunes you've suffered from your youth until now." So the king got up and sat in the city gateway, and when all the people were told, "Now the king is sitting in the gate," they came before the king. Meanwhile, Israel had fled, each man to his tent. And throughout all the tribes of Israel, there was dissension among the people. They were saying, "The king delivered us from the power of our enemies, and he saved us from the power of the Philistines, but now he has fled the land to escape Absalom. However, Absalom, who we anointed to rule us, is dead in battle. So now, why doesn't anyone suggest bringing the king back? King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiatar the Kohanim, the priests. Ask the leaders of Judah, why are you the last to bring the king back to his palace? The king has already heard that all Israel wants to return him to his palace. You are my kinsman. You are my flesh and bone. Why are you the last to bring back the king? Also tell Amasa, you are my flesh and bone. May God bring terrible curses on me and worse ones yet, if from now on you are not permanent commander of my army instead of Joab. Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah around as if they were one man, so that they sent a message to the king, come back, you, all of your servants. David is grief-stricken. He's destroyed. He's inconsolable. And in this state, he completely forgets who he is in God, what his duties are as God's anointed king of Israel, where his loyalties and his priorities ought to lay. Over and over, the only words that he seems to be able to form in his mouth are, my son Absalom. He wishes he had died instead of his son. I have no doubt he was completely sincere in that wish. You know, I think I can understand that. On more than one occasion, I've looked at my wife and my children, my grandchildren, and thought, I suppose selfishly, Lord, please allow me to die first before them. I don't think I could stand it if any of them perished while I was left to deal with it. And yet I know so many spouses who have gone on before them, whose sons and daughters have died of disease, maybe in defense of our nation, or in an accident, maybe at the hand of a criminal. And who found the inner strength, not only to go on living productively and with joy, but also able to glorify the Lord in the midst of it all. Sadly, the great King David didn't have that inner strength at this time. He only wanted to die so that his pain would finally leave him in peace. He cared more about the demise of this evil son than he did for all of his other loyal sons and daughters who were still alive. His many loyal wives, his faithful soldiers who had risked their lives for him, and his fellow countrymen who depended on his leadership now more than ever, this critical moment. Rashi makes the point. He makes a poignant remark, I think, about the opening words of this chapter. Trembling, the verse says. Trembling. The king went up to the room over the gate. Rashi sees this trembling not as an intense state of mourning, but rather as an intense state of guilt. David knew at the bottom of his heart that even Absalom's rebellion was on his head. He was at fault. All of this horror and death that was visited upon his family and upon his kingdom was the outpouring of God's curse upon him for David's terrible sins, most of them revolving around the Bathsheba incident. He felt personal responsibility. There was no shaking it. And you want to know something? He was right. And it is a lesson that we must all prepare for if we are going to deliberately sin against the Lord. If we're going to ignore his word and his commandments, why else should we expect anything other than the worst? I cringe when I hear very thoughtful believers state, oh, there's no consequence anymore for our sinning or our rebellion. Not earthly, not heavenly. Nothing could be less scriptural. Nothing could be less accurate. Our sins indeed have been forgiven upon the stripes and the blood of our Savior, Yeshua, but only in the spiritual and in the eternal sphere. We will indeed bear the earthly consequences of our trespasses. As David did, as David would until his dying breath. And it may suck in and devastate many among us who we love the most. My prayer is that we'll all recognize this hard fact. And so we seek God's strength that we avoid sinning in the first place. That begins with accepting his Messiah. Then, immediately learning his ways from his word and doing them. But if we should consider something else, then I pray that we recognize when God's punishment is upon us, as it was with David, and not deny the cause nor deflect the responsibility as though our trespasses against the Lord will have no consequences upon ourselves or others so long as we're redeemed. I doubt that any of us will ever achieve such a lofty place in God's eyes as did King David. But even that didn't stop the Lord from also laying a burdensome curse upon him for his terrible trespasses. We'll look at Joab's response to David's weeping and mourning next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.